job down at the local mill. Worked right up, not a millionaire. I can't pay my bills. The evil man is at my door. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. Well, I had me wife, two kids, a car, and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it. People, they used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working, we're not a working, we're just not working anymore.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you in the air by listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. Yay! We were off the air for a while, weren't we,
yes,
Bob?
Yes, 4 or 5 days.
Yeah. We were still streaming, though. Yeah.
We keep the stream going there.
Yes, but, you know, a lot of our listeners live out, live in Champaign-Urbana and a lot of the smaller towns, here, in about a 50 mile radius. So, a lot of them, were deprived somewhat, if you will, unless they went to their computers. But anyway, we're back on the air, and the views and expressions, views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers who do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Bob with some of our underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, which is at 1209 West Oregon in Urbana. For more information, visit centralilljwj.org. That's centralilljwj.org.
That's a little complicated.
Yeah. First time reading that new version there. Okay. So I'll get it down for next week.
All right.
The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And programming on the World Labor Hour supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. And the Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Bob. We got a very special guest here in the studio, whom we'll get to here shortly. And meantime, we've got some labor news headlines, starting with Bob.
All right, returning to the Volkswagen plant down there in Chattanooga. Just a week or so ago, November 12th, it comes out, says Volkswagen will allow labor organizations that can prove they represent at least 15% of the automaker's workers in Chattanooga company's workers to represent them in workplace discussions. So it says Volkswagen announces a new policy today that will open the door for multiple labor organizations, including the United Auto Workers, to represent workers at its plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee. It says here, given the beleaguered union a key achievement in the South. It says, for the United Auto Workers, winning an opportunity to officially represent workers at an assembly plant in the South would be a major accomplishment after years of losing elections at German and Asian auto plants in the U.S. However, Volkswagen's new policy falls short of providing the UAW with a pat towards the clear-cut exclusive recognition that the union had been hoping for. That's because Volkswagen's policy fails to recognize the UAW as the only bargaining agent. In fact, Volkswagen policy provides for three tiers of representation for labor organizations and allows any group to act as a representative with at least 15% of the workers signed up. Groups that can prove they have 15% of the members can meet monthly with Volkswagen's human resources executives. Groups that prove they can represent 30% and then 45% of workers gain additional representation rights. Any labor group that wants to be the exclusive bargaining agent must apply to the NLRB and prove it represents more than 50% of the workers. There is an anti-United Auto Workers group that calls itself the American Council of Employees, and it says that it wants to represent Volkswagen workers. So there's some good and some bad there. You know,
they're
allowing the union in and allowing multiple representative groups there. And, you know, one of the guys that was fiercely United Auto Workers is now going to run this American Council of Employees. And he said people were laughing the other day because he was working next to one of the most pro-United Auto Workers people on the same car on the assembly line. And people were laughing, saying, you know, look, here's the most fiercely pro-United Auto Workers guy working right next to the fiercely anti-United Auto Workers. But at least they're allowing some representation into that plant. And United Auto Workers still says that they have what they consider over 50% of the employees that are going to sign up to be represented by them.
While we're talking about the UAW, whatever happened to them in Flexengate here in town?
Good
we
question, Jim.
We haven't seen them anywhere.
We'll look into that.
I'm not so sure the UAW is the right union for this group.
We'll look into that, Jim. We'll report on that in next week or two.
Well, yeah. Along with that, in case you were mentioned this while I was out of the studio, what about UFCW, Kraft?
Yeah.
I haven't heard anything from them for what? I think at least 6 months.
Yeah, they were on the show with a couple organizers and
a couple
rank and filers, yeah.
And the UAW thing, what was that? Was that 2 years ago
where they
had kind of the big meeting in
Havana? Lots of protests and all sorts of publicity, rallies, against Flexengate's policy. We had one of the Congolese workers on, Patty Lumbunda, I think his name was. It was a classic case there of, I mean, God, it sounded so 19th century. Where they had four distinct ethnic groups in the plant, and the management constantly played the groups off against each other.
Yeah, there was a really great movie about the meat packers in Chicago in the early part of the 20th century, and I can't remember the name of it.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody remembers it, please tell me.
Upton Sinclair.
Well, it was, Was that the movie? It was a movie it was a movie made in the 1980s, and it wasn't Upton Sinclair.
Okay.
It was about the meat packers, their struggle unionizing.
Okay. All right.
It was a dramatic movie, very good movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry I don't remember the name of it. Maybe I can look it up. But anyway, here's another one, Dave. Were some of these, Congolese workers, what kind of visa were they brought here on?
You know, that's a very good question that's been raised before. They were legal residents, so they had some kind of visa that allowed them to work, evidently. Unlike a lot of the Latino workers who were working there, who I think a lot of them were undocumented.
Well, here's something because I believe I was under the impression that they were came in under some visa where they thought they were going to be computer programmers.
Academic
or something.
Visas, yeah.
And they ended up, you know, I don't know, maybe they're programming CNC machines out there or something to build bumpers.
They weren't
supposed to be like factory.
In fact, they were doing some of the most dangerous manual labor out there.
Yeah. And another one, and this is the Obama.
Yes.
I didn't mind what he wants to do,
yeah,
some of his things, except he wants to increase H-1B visas.
See, that's the thing.
Why do they keep doing that?
Well, you know why they keep doing that, Bill. This is typical ruling class, you know, game plan, you know.
Oh, thanks.
You know, it's basically to lower wages. You know, and I'll tell you what, I've been a big...
but this is lowering wages of profession. This is, you know, H-1B is supposed to be professional. And it's like every person that gets laid off at a factory, they send them to go study computer stuff.
Yeah.
Anymore, you know. I mean, I know so many people that's been stuck in that, and then they get done, and there's nothing for them to do.
Yes, indeed, indeed. Okay, yeah, I'll tell you what, this is a good topic for another show. I just have to say that, you know, as much of a critic I've been of Obama, it was like I was really happy to see him doing something right. But, you know, what really outraged me was how four networks that basically use the public airwaves and that are basically, you know, administered by the Federal Communications Commissions could deny the President of the United States access to the airwaves. Are you kidding me? I mean, this is outrageous. I mean, you know, this just shows you how far corporate control has come to in this country, in my opinion. You know, but anyway, wow, we got some topics for some future shows here already.
Yeah, we'll get updates on both of those things.
Indeed.
UAW at Guardian and the UFCW over there at Kraft.
Yeah, but very good question, Jim. Shows. And in a way, I think maybe it's not necessarily a bad thing for this situation of Volkswagen, because frankly, it's going to make the UAW a little bit more competitive, if you will, if there's other unions in there organizing to better represent the workers.
Oh. The guy who's heading that rival union down there said he wasn't so much anti-union as anti United Auto Workers.
Well,
you blame the union for a lot of what happened in Detroit.
You know, they have United Auto Workers have a very grand militant tradition. Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, United Auto Workers have a grand militant tradition back in the 30s and you know, all the way up through the 70s and 80s.
They could have been paying minimum wage at those car factories in Detroit, and they would have still got eaten by the Japanese.
They were making terrible cars, you know. I
mean, anybody remembers?
Well, that's not the fall of the workers.
Any car,
yeah,
built, right, like in the late 70s. Oh,
they
remember
were poorly
the
designed. They
oh,
fell
the Mustang
apart
2.
Yeah.
Vegas.
Okay. All right. Here is another interesting news story for the holidays coming up. Food bins to collect food for Walmart workers have reappeared as we head towards Black Friday. Walmart workers say bake sales are being organized at a store there to encourage workers to contribute to help fellow workers at Walmart put food on their tables. This spectacle of food drives for Walmart workers inside Walmart stores speaks louder than any words could about the morality and social justice, or lack of it, in working for the world's largest retailer owned by a family of billionaires and not being able enough to buy enough food. A report from Oxfam America says millions of Americans are struggling to provide enough food due to persistent low wages. Americans for Tax Fairness say Walmart's low wages are costing taxpayers $6.2 billion a year in public assistance for Walmart workers. Just one member of the ultra-rich Walton family that owns Walmart could pay that entire tab this year and still have more than $33 billion left over.
You know, this could be something for sort of a protest. We could go out there and stand out there by the drive and have like a big box and big sign say, donate food for hungry Walmart workers.
Okay, maybe next year.
Didn't you guys go out there on Black Friday?
Yeah, last year we had almost 100 people turn out. And Jim had a real interesting conversation. We had a confrontation with Walmart security, and they came up and tried to tell us that the public sidewalk we were on belonged to Walmart. And Jim, what did you tell the security? Well, oh, they threatened to call the police.
Yeah, well, first of all, I was surprised that didn't have a picket captain. I have never been on a picket line.
Okay,
before.
A topic for another time, but just go into the story because we got to move on here.
So I pointed myself because the guy was coming up toward my direction. And I said, okay, are you an employee of Walmart or are you with us on the picket line? He says, no, we work for Walmart. Okay, what do you want? You're on illegal pavement. I says, I don't think so. But we're going to call the police. I said, please do. Call the police. We'd love to take a bust. It would be great publicity for us and bad publicity for Walmart.
Certainly would.
They went right back in the store and never came back. So that was good. Okay, what else you got, Bob?
I got a couple quick updates once again on the Honeywell workers down there in Metropolis.
The story that won't go away, yes.
Well, as of November 10th, the United Steelworkers, USW, and their local 7-669 filed unfair labor practice charges with the NLRB concerning Honeywell's lockout of its union members going on since August 2nd of this year. The United Steelworkers deems the lockout to be illegal and in violation of the National Labor Relations Act, the NLRA. The union alleges Honeywell threatened to permanently replace its union workforce, illegally dealt directly with employees instead of bargaining with the union, and failed to respond to an information request from the union. Other alleged violations of the NLRA are the company's unilateral change to benefits and repeated demonstrations of anti-union animus. So, and another quick update here, charges for a coal CEO. A federal grand jury last week indicted former Massey Energy CEO Donald Blankenship on charges stemming from the April 2010 explosion at Massey's Upper Big Branch mine, which killed 29 miners. Blankenship faces two counts of conspiracy based on his role in a pattern of widespread mine safety and health violations at Upper Big Branch Mine, and two counts of securities fraud based on public statements by the company following the explosion. It says if convicted, Blankenship could face up to 31 years in prison, and I find this rather ironic because it says 6 years would be for the worker's death and up to 25 years for deceiving the investor.
Oh, wow. Don't that speak volumes?
Yes.
Wow. Okay, final news story here. Ferguson
police. I'm going to have some too.
Okay, go ahead, Jim.
Okay, this is, I talked to Peter Miller the other day. On the phone. Peter Miller, founder of, Illinois, actually at that time it was the East Central Illinois Labor Journal.
What year was that, back in 95?
95, I believe it was.
Yeah, same year my daughter was born.
Almost 20 years. And, anyway, he was telling me, he lives in New Hampshire now. He works for the New Hampshire Education Association, basically. I believe he's one of their UNICEF
IEA
directors.
Teachers Union,
Yeah, which was,
I mean, not NEA Teachers Union, yeah.
Like a, business agent for him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, he was telling me about, something that Verizon did. And, it's similar to what's happened here. Some of the rural people here, might, realize that, what was it, 2 or 3 years ago, Verizon sold its landline service to a company called Frontier. Now, I don't know what their union status is.
In Bloomington Normal, it's, IBEW.
Okay, I don't know what it is around where I'm at. But anyway, but basically Verizon's decided to get rid of all of their landline business as soon as they can, except for places where they find it profitable to install fiber optics, which is not in rural areas.
Of course not.
Okay. Now, what happened in New Hampshire, which is pretty much a rural state, is that they sold out to a company called Fairpoint Communications. Okay, now like Frontier, they kind of specialize in rural landline service. All right. Anyway, it's based in North Carolina.
Okay.
All right. And anyway, this is from Wikipedia. In 2007, Fairpoint had 330,000 access points or customers. In that year, Verizon Communications announced plans to sell its landline operations in Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont to Fairpoint for $2.7 billion. Of that amount, $1.7 billion would go to Verizon Communications in cash and debt, and approximately approximately $1 billion would go to Verizon shareholders in Fairpoint common stock, and Verizon would hold no stock. Now, Peter said that the unions at the time, which I believe there was four IBEW locals and one CWA local, warned about the debt and criticized the company taking on that debt for this service. And anyway, approximately 1.6 million phone customers and 230,000 high-speed internet users in the three states were added to Fairpoint's customer base, with the result that the Northern England New England customers represent 85% of Fairpoint's customers, and that made Fairpoint the eighth largest phone company in the United States,
mm-hmm.
or the eighth largest company heavily invested in a dying business.
Okay.
Because landlines, I don't even have a landline out at my yeah. house in the country anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I have a fake landline.
Mm-hmm.
This, we're sort of the cell system. All right, and on May 5th, 2009, Fairpoint went bankrupt. And anyway, as a result of the bankruptcy, Verizon shareholders lost the entire $1 billion of shares they had received in the previous year's deal. And anyway, they sold their pay phones, which was probably a good idea. That's a dying business. And on October 14th, 2014, Fairpoint Communications froze the pensions of nearly 2,000 employees who had built, maintained, and serviced their communications throughout Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. The company had already stopped providing retiree health care and support for child and elder care. Workers said that this was all part of Fairpoint's plan to turn their good middle-class jobs into low-wage temporary jobs. This is kind of weighted for Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Also, the implications and trickle-down effect of nearly 2,000 unemployed New England workers has caused ripples leading to waves in local and regional economies through the three states. Unions representing the employees have been negotiating with the company since April to reach new collective bargaining agreements. Leaders of the IBEW and the CWA said that Fairpoint management abandoned the bargaining process on August 27th after refusing to compromise on any substantive issues since negotiations began. Fairpoint, funny mm-hmm. name.
Yeah, yeah.
Replaced striking workers with Craigslist ad respondents from as far away as Oregon and California. The replacement workers struggled to maintain any semblance of normal service as a series of nor'eastern storms brought rain and snowy winter conditions to the three-state area. Fairpoint spokeswoman Angela Beaudry acknowledged that, quote, long answer times had customers calling back multiple times, unquote. Beaudry admitted that Fairpoint has struggled to respond to service requests and said company officials, quote, regret some of our customers have been inconvenienced as we had to reschedule.
Okay. Yeah, I saw that post here on so there's a campaign now for the Fairpoint workers then? Okay, we'll probably have to do an update on that because I'm sure there's some kind of action going on.
Well, Peter wants us to get somebody on the
Okay, maybe you can help arrange that, Bill. Okay, last news stories we have. Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson, who shot and killed unarmed teenager Michael Brown on August 9th, is in the final stages of negotiations with city officials to resign, according to people close to the talks. Wilson could announce as soon as Friday his plans to resign the same day as St. Louis County Grand Jury meets to deliberate and possibly decide on an indictment. The talks could still collapse, these people said. Wilson doesn't know what the grand jury will do, and if they return charges, he could change his mind. Anyway, in a video released Thursday, the father of Michael Brown called for calm and asked the public to act peacefully in the upcoming days when a grand jury plans to announce its decision on whether or not to indict Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson in the final shooting of the unarmed black teenager. Demonstrations in St. Louis Wednesday night led to the arrest of six protesters, and many fear that the jury's verdict could lead to violence and further arrests. However, Michael Brown Sr. made a statement urging his supporters to continue to lift their voices while reminding them that hurting others or destroying property is not the answer. Well, if they come back with a non-guilty verdict or something, they need to shut that city down. I mean, peacefully, non-violently, but disruptively, you know. And I mean, this is what, you know, I had a friend, John Ryman, who's been on the show, who actually went to Ferguson back in, I think it was October, November, and he said it was really interesting in the sense that there was a lot of people who came from all over the country, both good and bad. Good and bad in the sense is that you had a lot of opportunistic people who were trying to divert the crowd to do meaningless things like march around an empty parking lot or you know, other stuff, and they seemed like they were actually working for the authorities, you know, to try to discourage people and everything else. But he said what was inspiring was that the local Ferguson residents, mostly young people, you know, in their teens, 20s, and, you know, 30s, were just, he said it was incredible of how quickly they became very well organized. And you know, and of course he talked a lot about how the police provoked almost every single incident, you know, of confrontation and violence and stuff. So, but anyway, any day now, that's going to come down, and I got a feeling there's going to be some
provocateurs there as well.
Yeah.
Well, there's been a big kerfuffle with the KKK now, too.
Oh, yes. And I heard Anonymous hacked their website and Twitter stuff.
Oh, yeah. Now the KKK's sent all their clothing it in some kind of self-defense law.
To the police?
Talking about being hunters, you know, that they would kill people. And it, here's something strange. I've been working on a crew of mainly St. Louis people.
Oh, really?
For all year. And I remember when this first happened, one person, I heard one person say, well, the people of Ferguson are always looking for something. But then I have never heard anybody talk about this.
Uh-huh.
All these people from around St. Louis.
Interesting. Okay, we're going to take a quick music break. We'll be right back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on Listener Supported Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned.
Now we're going to Gus, I assume.
Gotta pull this timber before the sun goes down. Get it across the river before the falls come round. Drag it on down that dusty road. Come on, Jerry, let's dump this load.
Hauling
timber. Been everywhere and he ain't no fool. Work gets heavy, old Jerry gets sore. Pull so much and won't pull no more.
Hauling
timber, timber. Lord, this timber got a roll.
Timber,
timber, timber. Lord, this timber got a roll.
Okay, that was Josh White from a song from the 1930s, 40s about a work gang doing timber and about abusive bosses and about the most bravest person in the crew being a mule that I guess kicked the boss to death. So, you know, this anyway, we had a couple quick public service announcements. Another sports show, 104.5 WRFU today, Saturday from 2 to 3, hosted by fellow worker Neil Parthen. And then on Sunday from 3 to 4 on Urbana Public Television, Comcast Channel 6 is 9/11 TV program, followed by Labor World's View TV from 4 to 5 p.m., and that's on Comcast Channel 6 Sunday, tomorrow, Sunday, and every Sunday. Okay, now I would like to introduce our special guest, Gus Wood. Gus, welcome back to the World Labor Hour.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it, Dave. It's great being back. So.
Okay. So, tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a second year PhD student in history. I specialize in looking at black working class resistance, organizing against race and capitalism. So really what I'm trying to do is look at the main objectives and issues that the black working class has faced since they became the black working class in America. So we're talking about labor struggles, of course, since economics is the number one reason why the black working class is so oppressed. Also housing struggles and also state-sponsored private and systemic violence from police and private citizens as well.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the things that I look at, and my project is going to be looking at Atlanta in the 1960s and going up and looking at the transformations amongst the black working class and how they organized around race and capitalism.
Okay.
In Atlanta.
And you're originally from Atlanta, right?
Yes, born and raised.
Okay, yeah. Hence your interest in this, focusing on that topic. Yeah. But that's an interesting project to focus just on one city, you know, I mean, cause, wow, you know, it's like the more you get into history in general, but even with African American history and, or labor history, I mean, wow, where do you start? And, you know, it's vast, and there's so many interconnections and stuff. And, so today though, you want to come on and, talk a little bit about this, and I guess, where do we start?
Yeah, I mean, that's the issue really, is that you don't have enough either social science history, anything coming out that talks about labor struggles, especially in the South and for black labor.
Mm-hmm.
Very little has come out, especially in Atlanta and other areas, because most of the literature that comes out of there is very top-down, bourgeoisie-driven, elite history.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in, of course, you know, the black masses make up the majority of, the black working class make up the majority of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But very little has been written about them. So a lot of people don't understand how capitalism and racism really work at an individual level and on the ground, because we're not producing these things at a high volume like we should. So that's what, you know, I'm calling on other scholars to do as well.
Okay.
Is to take the narratives of the people,
mm-hmm,
to really understand how oppression works. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting the fact that it seems like as soon as, you know, the Jamestown settlement, you know, of course, part of that was the failed Roanoke settlement in the early 1600s. But it's almost like as soon as these, I mean, really, what was the basis for these explorers? I mean, wasn't it basically pre-corporations that were looking for a profit, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, through the nobility, if you will, the different countries or...
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the main purpose for them going is to find some type of economic stability and to find, you know, they, you know, when I was teaching high school, one of the things I like to tell students is that this was all about this glory and this religious aspirations. But no, the first thing that the Virginia Company told them was, you need to pay us back the loan that we're giving you. Or, you know, is you're going to be in trouble. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing was we need to find a place. We need to find a profitable crop or some type of source of economic stability to pay back our loan to come to this area. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're going to start off with they're going to find tobacco from the Native Americans and they're going to wipe them out and take their crops. And of course, they're going to need somebody to cultivate those crops and they're going to start with indentured servitude. Mm-hmm. And of course, that becomes a problem because when I have a white worker, what's going to happen, a poor white worker, what's going to happen is after a while, he's on the contract. And when that contract goes up, he's going to become eligible to be competition for land owning and property rights. And that's going to upset the balance of commercial capitalism. Okay. So that's amazing. Oh.
Yeah. Well, there's during the first settlement of Jamestown, wasn't there a problem because they had a lot of lower level young nobility aristocrats in the colony and they basically refused to work.
Exactly.
Okay. So they needed it right off, I mean, it's almost
that, yeah.
Yeah, look at what we're suffering now is a result of, that type of a class thing, perpetrated by corporations. Mm-hmm. Plus settlement by religious nuts. That's how we started.
American History Nutshell by Bill Gorrell.
Okay. Because, you know, this is Thanksgiving weekend, and you have the whole pilgrim thing.
He's right, yeah. The majority of people that came over were of a ruling elite bourgeoisie class. Mm-hmm. So, of course, they're not used to this type of work. You know, in Europe, you have slavery, you have serfdom, you have things like that. So I'm not going to work. So, of course, there were episodes of cannibalism going on because of not having enough food to farm because the people were, like you said, inherently lazy. Mm-hmm. They did not want to do the work. We need somebody to do the work for us and so that we can have free labor to make a profit off of. So,
And they kind of, before Jamestown settlement, they kind of did a little practice run in Ireland, of course. And then, when they came here, they kind of, took it to another level. Mm-hmm. They took their genocide and their forms of, forced servitude up to a whole different level with the genocide of the Indians and, of course, the importation of Africans,
actually, before the colonization, the East Coast of the United States was very heavily populated
with Native Americans.
Mm-hmm. However, the very early trading and exploratory missions that came over pre-colonization spread smallpox.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And by the time that, say, the Pilgrims and the people from Jamestown came over, the East Coast population was decimated.
Okay. Yeah, so anyway, so then basically the settlements are formed, and after about 100 or so years, basically a growing a colony and comprised of some what they called free labor, basically, you know, carpenters, craftsmen who don't work for anybody, carpenters, various tradespeople who work for an employer, then you had, of course, African slaves and European, mainly Irish indentured servants, you had some free Africans eventually that, I mean, what I understand is even in some states in the South, some even owned slaves, which I thought was really bizarre looking at some of this. But that was were exceptions, you know.
Yeah, those were exceptions.
But you got this interesting dynamic going on of different working people of different, ethnic backgrounds that, you know, it seems to me, had a lot in common, but it seems like not too far on that all of a sudden there was like conflicts between them.
Yeah.
Do you think those conflicts were at least encouraged, if not created by the ruling class in this country?
Oh, of course, definitely. I mean, we have to be clear in that the black worker, the slave, I call them black workers because that's what they were. I mean, they contributed to capitalism. The black worker is foundational to the creation of this country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were central and their labor, of course, if you compare it to others at that time, like you said, it was always considered the worst and lowest conditions of any modern labor. Some estimate that the maintenance of a slave in the South cost a master only about $19 a year, which means that they were among the poorest paid laborers in the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
They represent the very sense of the ultimate degradation of mankind. No matter how degraded the factory hand, he is not real estate because we were considered chattel. We were property. You know, you look at people and they think about what does a slave do? A slave was supposed to be a person, somebody that worked off their debt or worked for some type of system. But American chattel slavery was the selling of property, was the selling of treating us like cattle, like we were animals on farms. And that's how they treated us. And that's why you had the breeding system come along too that, exacerbated profit making in terms of capitalism, things like that. So mm-hmm. it became a very systemic issue amongst the black workers. And what's going to happen is that you're going to have the white workers who are going to come in who at first, like place during instances like Bacon's Rebellion are going to, you're going to see some type of unity come along. But one thing that the ruling class, the bourgeoisie told the white workers is that, hey, you have to look at black slavery as being less than you because they are doing the lowest work because they are free labor. You all are able to make some wages in your work and your skin is white, so therefore you are better than them. So what that does is that kills the unity and the solidarity amongst the working class people to have that working class revolution mm-hmm. to knock out capitalism.
Plus there were severe penalties too.
Exactly.
White workers to fraternize, black workers or marry or, you know, have relationships of any kind. I mean, whether
exactly.
that's, romantic or worker, organization, what have you.
You can't have a miscegenation.
Yeah.
It's important to point out that the founding fathers realized that the British Parliament was slowly gaining a majority to abolish slavery. This is rarely known. And that part of it was the fact that especially the Southern were all for it because they knew this was going to happen. Eventually, and it did. In 1815, the British outlawed slavery. So that's when the breeding started because they could no longer legally import slaves.
When was the last African American imported to the United States as a slave? Was that like early 1800s?
Yeah, definitely early 1800s. But again, what you had was you still had illegal trading going on.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And you had Africans being brought to America as late as the 1840s and 50s. The Amistad mm-hmm. case was one of the most famous ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that happened like consistently across the lines. But one of the things I also want to bring up is key to that schism between the white and black workers
mm-hmm.
is that, you know, not just the fact that you look at black labor, black free labor as being negative, but also being a part of the system of slavery gave poor white workers a sense of, you know, validity and credibility. They felt good about being overseers. They felt good about being members of the patrol system.
Mm-hmm.
So this was something that they aspired to be as part of that ruling class because they were so poor. I mean, we have to be clear that very small population of white people in this country back during those times were educated
mm-hmm.
and were able to own land.
Mm-hmm.
So they aspired to join that very small elite class. But again, with capitalism, you can't have that balance messed up because if you have too many people joining that ruling class, it's going to upset the profit margins. And so the ruling class, especially in the North, a lot of people don't look at the Northern capitalists as being a part of this, but they were very instrumental in making sure that you're going to have this system stay in place no matter what happens in terms of keeping the working class and the black working class or the black slaves apart from each other so that you cannot, you know, there was no chance for social mobility because it would upset the labor force and system.
Yeah, a very excellent book that, in fact, Gus recommended that I've started reading, W.E.B. Du Bois' Black Reconstruction in America, where he talks about this phenomenon in the South besides the, European-American workers that worked for the plantation in some form or another, you had a vast array of, extremely poor whites living out like in the countryside and stuff. I mean, in basically almost animal-like conditions, that basically, that some of them had some skills and stuff, and it seemed like because the plantation had their own in shop, tradesmen. We're talking African American tradesmen, blacksmiths, carpenters, whatever. That instead of seeing this as them, you know, this always fascinated me, was that instead of them seeing the plantation owners being the source of this problem, they looked down on the Africans who were doing the work. Mm-hmm. You know, that basically put them out of work. And I draw to me a parallel to what we have currently with kind of this whole immigration issue.
Dave.
I was not blaming the real culprit, instead blaming the fellow victim.
Exactly. Yeah, earlier we were talking about the Congolese at the at Flexing Gate.
Yes.
And I was talking to an old friend of mine, and this guy works at Super Value. And I don't know what Super Value does out there, but it seems like they really turn the heads of people. And I said, yeah, it's really weird, man. These guys are from Africa, and they got French accents. You know? And he goes... And, you know, they're organizing a union, and he goes, well, if they don't like it, why don't they just go back?
Wow.
And, but, you know, like, that counts for the native, I guess, people who work there, native born, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to comment quickly. There was a movie that opened yesterday around the nation, 21 cities, I think, called Food Chains.
Food Chains.
Yeah, Amy Goodman mentioned it this week, and Paul Muth mentioned it. And it's basically about the coalition of Immokalee workers.
Down in Florida, yeah.
We've reported on them before. Mm-hmm. And one of the writers and producers says, we live like animals in cramped housing. They work 9-hour days, make $42 a day.
Oh.
They have to pick 480 pounds of fruit in an hour to make that kind of money. They're getting paid a penny a pound for tomatoes and stuff like that.
Wow.
They live in jam-packed trailers and ragtag encampments. So this stuff is still going on today.
Yeah. Check
out that movie if you get a chance, Food Chains.
Okay.
And they're also one of the most able and organized groups around. They've even gone underground and got people busted for slavery, man. They voluntarily went in as slaves.
They've actually got more money, a penny a pound more out of Walmart and stuff, which is quite a feat, you know.
You know, McDonald's.
Sure. They're still fighting.
And that's the one thing that we have to always remember when we have these discussions, is that there's going to be a dialectical relationship between oppression and resistance. You know, that's one of the best things that Du Bois talks about in Black Reconstruction, and other people have mentioned as well, is that you're going to have this very oppressive state, but the black workers were always organizing, resisting, whether it be infra-political, day-to-day resistance, or it was organized rebellions that were happening at this point. I mean, that's a very key thing, and that's why when you look at the Civil War, you know, Du Bois argues that the black worker was the critical catalyst in the winning of the Civil War because of what he calls the general strike, whereas then over 4 million black workers were the crutch of the economic situation in terms of food, in terms of supplies and things like that for the army, in the Confederate army. So what happens is when you have about 500,000 of them actually just walk off the plantation, it severely starts crippling the economic situation for the South. So, and then you're going to move, and then as time went on, and then the North started occupying southern areas, and they were taking slaves and freeing them, and they were becoming contraband for the army. What's going to happen is you're going to start seeing that 500,000 balloon, and you're going to see over almost half of the African American workers join in the army and taking away that labor force for the South, crippling it.
Mm-hmm.
So again, that was a conscious effort by the black workers to fight their economic situation. That wasn't some, like whatever type thing. Like like the Northern Army went and got them. You know, they consciously walked off and they had a strike, as in what we do. You know, like a lot of people don't think of that as a strike because they were slaves, but we have to remember that slaves were workers in the sense that they were arguing and they were protesting against their working conditions. So that's a very prominent part of history that we have to remember, that working class resistance was dependent on, ended the Civil War because of what the black workers
that
did.
That is fascinating, and we're going to have to take a quick music break and we're right back, and I want to pick up on that. So as we come back, you're listening to World Laborer on WFT, Listen Sport Community Radio Station, in Champaign, Illinois. Be right back.
Superman is back as your hero. Hear ye, hear yo. I'm America, the beautiful, beautiful, the plentiful. Now looking sort of pitiful. A third of the world at war. Wait a minute, gotta take care of that rock if y'all wanna live in it. Medicine and Medicare, cause they don't care. Your favorite millionaire is in the air. See him everywhere, but they ain't there. So rally and protest, cause the world in fear. Now people, people, can we take it to the square? Yeah, yeah. Now, you don't matter, and they don't mind. Cause these be the things that make you blind. Come on.
Okay, that was Public Enemy, Things That Make You Blind. And we're back in the World Labor Hour. And Jim, during the music break, you had an interesting point about the Civil War.
Yes. Haiti, who had completed a successful and only successful slave rebellion in 1802, offered 15,000 volunteers to fight with Lincoln.
In the Union Army.
In the Union Army. Hmm. Now, what's interesting was, of course, they may have showed up or not, but probably not, because there was contact was made with them and said, well, what we will do is recognize you as a state.
Oh,
so Lincoln was the first president to recognize Haiti.
Okay. Now, you mentioned a book before about Haiti, C.L.R. James.
C.L.R. James, yeah. The Black Jacobins, yes.
Okay. A book, another one on my list to read yet. So, okay, let's also during music break, Gus brought up another real fascinating point besides, African-American slaves walking off, you know, banning the plantations and hence depriving the Confederate Army of food and other supplies. You mentioned another interesting fact that happened, too. What was that?
Yeah, I mean, it just goes from the fact that this was not merely a desire to stop the work. It was the strike on the whole basis of the conditions of the work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The labor forces at the time were, I mean, like I said before earlier, the oppressive system in terms of for black workers and white workers, it was unsteady. It was nasty. It was inhumane. So when the black workers walked off, you're going to have also you're not going to have any type of way to make profits or to make supplies for the war.
Mm-hmm.
And then also you have the white working class who at first were looking at the black workers as being inferior. They look now at the war itself as being very degenerative to what they want to do when they want to be socially mobile and move up into the ruling class elite. So what you have left in the South during the Civil War is you have no working class to fulfill capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is the South basically runs out of supplies and they run out of time while the North is, when the North is occupying territory.
Yeah.
So that's the end of the war right there, when the black workers autonomously create this general strike to leave and protest their conditions of working, go to the North and become contraband to the Northern Army. And they also set up, there's a couple of places they also set up. There was an experiment at Davis Bend, Mississippi. This place was occupied by the Union Army in November, December 1864. And private interests there, the capitalisms were displaced in an interesting socialist effort made with all the property under the control of the government. So the Bend was divided into districts with Negro sheriffs and judges who were allowed to exercise authority under the general control of the military officers. So what you had was petty theft and idleness were soon reduced to a minimum, and the community distinctly demonstrated the capacity of blacks to take care of themselves and exercise themselves under honest and competent direction and the functions of their own self-government. So you had, this is one of the major examples of mass self-determination,
mm-hmm,
of black workers creating a system for themselves in a very socialist mindset.
And this is part of the Freetown
I mean, this is one of the first ones that sprang up, and this was during the Civil War.
Okay.
So not only did you have them protesting their conditions, mm-hmm, and walking out plantations in the South and stopping capitalism, but they also tried to transform the system and create their own socialist movement in different areas as well, to show that we can run our own, we can take care of each other, and we can profit off of each other's own production. Like, we can own our own production without having to oppress other people.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay,
it was a very powerful movement.
What happened to it? I mean,
Well, you know, what ends up happening, of course, after the Civil War ends, you're going to have a really powerful chance. And this is what Du Bois talks about. This was a powerful, powerful chance for the real workers, proletariat revolution to take over and end capitalism in America, because white workers and black workers were actually coming together to work together during Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. That's why the cusp of the book is about black Reconstruction, because it was a period when it was a unilateral anger and nastiness towards capitalism. It doesn't work. It hurts the masses. We need to stand against it. But what happens is those northern capitalists come down and they notice that there are blacks taking political positions in the South. So they work together to try to upend that system, and you have a series of nasty political assassinations. I mean, people literally walking into offices of black politicians and shooting them, leaving them dead. And these were, the Vicksburg Massacre 1875 is one of the biggest examples of this, where the northern capitalists working with racist groups like the KKK and other groups, just they said it was a systemic take back. It was a redemption of trying to go back into agrarian capitalism, okay, and saying, "No, this is what we're going to continue to do," and they're going to keep it going with sharecropping and convict leases and things like that. So
you could say, in essence, that a lot of these northern capitalists and their agents who worked for them sort of were indirectly responsible for the creation of the Ku Klux Klan.
Well, definitely. I mean, yeah, you can.
Wow.
I mean, it's
question. What part did the Hayes-Tilden decision play in this? That was ended Reconstruction.
Yeah, that was part of it, because what happens is when the Union soldiers are in the South, and because they have a very strict discipline system there, when they're taken out of the South, you have the ability for groups like the KKK, White Nationalist League, to go in and actually start taking political leaders out, taking the black coats coming in and taking threats of violence against anybody that tried to move up economically. Mm-hmm. So, this is all part of a very systemic redemption tactic to keep capitalism as a very stronghold in the country.
And this was like about 1876 or so?
Mm-hmm. 1870.
Okay. And it was interesting too, because that was the same year as the what they call the Great Railroad Strike, or the Great Rebellion, mm-hmm. when they moved federal troops out of the South to come north to put that down and to basically be prepared for other future uprisings in the industrial North.
Then. Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah. So you see that everything is working together in terms of, okay, not only do we have to make sure agrarian capitalism is going well in the South, but we're starting to move in towards the Gilded Age, and industrial capitalism is starting to take form as well. So what we have to realize is that these racializations and that these modes of production were very determinant on what happened to African Americans in this country. That because of the changing of the political economy, you're going to have a change in the way that African Americans were oppressed, killed, and economically exploited. And also how they resisted those things, because you're going to have them turning into, unionization is going to start coming along very soon. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have black groups forming unions like the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, 1920s.
Yes.
So you're going to have, like I said, we always have to remember there's a dialectical relationship between this oppression and the resistance to it. Mm-hmm. Because, like Vladimir Lenin said, the greatest oppression is going to always lead to the greatest democracy and resistance. I mean, it has to exist.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a paraphrase. He didn't say it just like that, but that's what he meant, that mm-hmm. we have to always remember that. So, and when we look at what's going on today in current times, people are getting very angry at the declining of the working class. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are really starting to get upset that they have to go out and get 2-3 jobs just to feed their families, that they don't have health care, they don't have situations to stabilize their household. So you're going to start seeing a lot more anger. And when you just mentioned Ferguson, mm-hmm. That's another situation as well. I mean, the economic situation around the country, that plays a part, just like the Rodney King verdict in 1991. Those people weren't rioting solely because of that beating for Rodney King. They were rioting because the Los Angeles economic conditions were so deplorable under Reagan that they just really just popped. They just needed a spark to pop.
Yes.
But all these things play in the factor that we have to really look at that relationship and how we could use it to better the lives of the masses.
Yeah, and this might explain why there's so much militarization of the police, in the sense that this thing mm-hmm. a couple of years ago was the Occupy movement, which started in Zuccotti Park in New York, but spread all over the country. I mean, it was incredible. At one point, I went online and saw there was over 1,000 some Occupy movements of groups all over the country, in small towns in the South and the Midwest, as well as the larger cities. This had to have scared the crap out of the ruling class.
I mean, and what's crazy about it is that this is something that, and it goes to this whole point of, that a lot of people, especially at the university, like to use this word civility. How to be civil in this situation. But again, they're militarizing the police, because what's happening is that you have you have an uncivil situation that is occurring, and you have people saying be civil in an uncivil, you know, foundationally racist and capitalist system. Mm-hmm. How can we pretend to be civil in a system that treats us as uncivil people?
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. You know, like, it's trying to put a square into a circle hole. Mm-hmm. The only way for us to really understand and how to break this system is to actually change it. Mm-hmm. We can't exist and try to, you know, be and actually take care of each other in this type of system. We have to work in, we have to infiltrate it. Things like what Carol Ammons is doing as state representative, taking those political positions that actually determine the socioeconomic viability of people, or doing things like community groups, social movement organizing on the ground level. These are things that we can do to change the system instead of trying to just simply exist in it.
Yes.
Because that's why they're militarizing the police, because they see people forming these groups and trying to change the system. And by changing the system, you're going to affect capitalism. You're going to affect the profit margin, the surplus value, the things they really care about. And they've always cared about since Jamestown.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to make sure that we can try to break that in any way possible.
Now, what we have here is a question of class consciousness. The American working class, especially the Anglo working class, does not have a sense of itself, a class in itself, for itself. Now, with the advent of the American Railway Union, for the first time, you had blacks and whites in the same union under Eugene V. Debs. And I hate to say it, in my hometown of Milwaukee, you know, where the Socialist Party was born and all that, there was a real reluctance to letting blacks in the unions. I mean, this was, you know, it's part of the game. And so Victor Berger's got a black eye on that one. Other than that, he taught Marxism to Debs in prison after the failure of the Pullman strike, and he was in the in jail.
This is what's also interesting, is I noticed Dubois touches on this, and I've seen this in other accounts too, is that, you know, you've got a real mixed bag here of organized labor, going back as far as the 1830s, which I admit, you know, I'm pretty, you know, well versed on labor history, starting pretty much with the Great Uprising of 1876 forward, but I don't know a whole lot about prior to that, where Dubois touches on this, the 1830s, the 1840s, yeah, you know, up through the Civil War. And it's amazing how you have these similar trends that continue. You have some labor organizations like the Knights of Labor that were inclusive of all ethnicities and genders. And then you had like the early, like, but then it seems like that there are a lot of other labor organizations that were like hostile to black workers, both the ones on the plantation in the South, and especially to what they called free black labor, and they looked at them as like competition, kind of like a lot of people look at of immigrant workers now. Not to say there's not real problems associated with that, basically, where the capitalist class is basically pitting them against each other to try to undermine their wages and conditions.
But yeah,
mm-hmm.
The
yes, I'll tell you what. You know what? If someone would like to call in, you could call in at 359-5483 and you know, just tell us a little bit what you think and everything. But we're gonna go a little bit into Union Edge today, preempted just a little bit, so maybe if anybody out there would like to call in, we'd love to hear from you.
Hold on a second.
Yes.
Besides that, I mentioned earlier a movie about organizing the meat packers in Chicago in the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah.
I have found it. It's called The Killing Floor. It was produced in 1984. Alfred Woodward, that's a name I recognize. And anyway, it's a great movie. I haven't seen it for ages, but the entire movie is here on YouTube. Go to YouTube, search Killing Floor Movie. And you will have to go through a whole bunch of movies that are about slaughtering people that have the same name, but after you get down about the bottom of the page, you'll find the movie you're looking for.
Okay. Yeah, and real quick, that reminds me, that's another interesting labor struggle in which you had African-American and white workers both at each other's throats and organizing together.
Well, and where multiple ethnic groups and languages, they had to have, one of the things in this movie is that the meetings, they have to have about four or five interpreters.
And also the role of the black churches in Chicago. Some were very pro-union and helped out the workers. Others, unfortunately, worked with George Washington Carver, who was sort of an elitist person in his own right who liked to hang out with Henry Ford and those who actually recruited poor African Americans in the South to bring them up to be strike breakers. And you know, you see a lot of this history though. Most of the time, these strike breakers aren't told they're going in to break a strike. No. They're told we got great opportunities for you. Next thing they get there, and they see all these people with clubs and stones, and they're wondering what the heck's going on. So that's another interesting aspect in this. But we're going to take a real quick music break. We're going to be right back, and we're going to preempt a little bit of Union Edge to continue this conversation. So stay tuned.
Put their club upside your head and then accuse you of attacking them. My brothers and sisters, we have to put a stop to this. And it will never be stopped until we stop it ourselves. This is American democracy. And those of you who are familiar with it know that in America, democracy is hypocrisy. Now, if I'm wrong, put me in jail. But if you can't prove that if democracy is not hypocrisy, then don't put your hands on me.
This time the revolution will be televised. Yeah. Broadcast live through Mandela's eyes. Sparked by the speech of Martin. Blocks rally in the streets, they marching. The greedy banks die a thousand thousand. By any means necessary, Malcolm X. Yes. We locking arms from Boston to Compton. Risking arrest to get the mission accomplished.
What we fighting for?
We fighting for our kids' future.
Against who?
Against the sons of J. Edgar Hoover.
From the Great Depression
to the Great Recession.
This is the home of the brave.
Where's the great redemption? Homeland victory. Joan of Arc refused to move, think Rosa Parks. Super rich Warren Buffett said tax the wealthy. Citizen militia Prince Machiavelli. Heartbreak Hill, we ain't built to lose a marathon. Assalamu alaikum, Louis Farrakhan. From the roots of Bob Marley. With the vision and the attitude of Marcus Garvey.
Show me what democracy looks like. This is what democracy looks like. Tell me what democracy looks like.
Who we shooting? Revolutionary suicide, Huey Newton. Leaders rise up and stand tall for all. Liberation, ammo car for brawl. The law set up for nefarious judgment. We abolitionists, Harriet Tubman, Mohandas Gandhi. Struggle for civil rights, Nat Turner brought batteries to the pillow fight. Black Panthers in a concrete jungle. Feast of famine when economies crumble. For every action, there's a reaction. And there's more to the death of Michael Jackson.
Show me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Tell me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Show me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Tell me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like. Knowledge is power, so inform the youth. I swear to tell the truth, the whole sojourner truth. Put a chink in our armor. Tactical regiment, Che Guevara. Mumia convicted in jail for homicide. Rastafari, Hail Selassie.
Okay, we're back. World Labor Hour. That was a band out of Boston called Twice Thou, and the name of the song was Democracy. So anyway, we're back with Gus Wood. We're going to preempt a little bit of the Union Edge. If you'd like to call in at 359-5483, we'd love to hear from you. But during the music break, one of our co-hosts in here asked a question of Gus: is how did word spread? I mean, this is to basically during the period of when the Civil War, when the South was starting to lose and the Union Army was advancing into the South, and how there were these large scale general strikes with slaves just walking off the plantations and providing the Confederacy of food and other materials. Considering this was pre-internet, pre-telephone, how did the word spread? I mean, from one plantation to another.
Well, one of the biggest things, of course, well, there were two things mainly. The first thing, of course, were writings and media. Things like,
But people didn't, not that many people knew how to read at that time, did they?
Well, you had,
in general,
you had secret ways that, because of course, African American and African peoples, our culture is dependent on what we call the griot, speaking history and being able to talk to one another. So you would have individuals who could read and write, who would speak these things and be able to spread them word to word. But also you had the transportation of literature, like Gabriel Prosser's Conspiracy, Thomas Paine's Common Sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, things like that. I mean, the idea that, you know, you should be free from oppressive labor, oppressive systems of, you know, things like that. So these things were spreading all over the place, and that the slaves were saying the things to each other, and they were just, you know, it was a mass movement. And, you know, when the Union armies were coming in, the slaves were walking off the plantations. When they were going from area to area and they were freeing those slaves, I mean, they were spreading these words to people. So it was a lot of propaganda in the air during the Civil War. Okay. That was very important.
And this happened again as kind of a similar parallel in the 1930s, right? Like, yep. During all the organizing and everything that was going on then.
Yeah. The only issue with that is that somebody brought up earlier about the union work. You know, mm-hmm. We talked about how there was a lot of issues in terms of the major unions. 24 unions, a lot of them affiliated with the AFL, mm-hmm. actually barred blacks from being in the union or practicing, and they also, or some of them practice other forms of exclusion and discrimination when mm-hmm. they were there. Joe Trotter's Black Milwaukee talks about that, which is another great book about how the black working class existed in terms of union work, not just how they existed in their actual work itself, but how they interacted with the unions and how mm-hmm. they formed their own unions in response to issues of racial discrimination. And
yeah, and I was aware of that fact. You know, but it's interesting, being a carpenter, a retired union carpenter, I know that, you know, the founder of the Carpenters Union in 1881 was a socialist named Peter McGuire. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is the first vice president of the National Union was a man out of the Carolinas named Rames. His last name was Rames. Mm-hmm. And he was basically the vice president. But see, everything was, they had segregated locals. Mm-hmm. And I guess, I don't know, you could criticize on one hand, but on the other hand, I guess if they were going to organize in the South in 1881, that was probably about the only way they could do it.
Well, Dave,
but you have instances like this, so it's kind of a mixed bag. I think, you know, probably in the main, you are right that, you know, that basically the majority of a lot of these unions did exclude. There were exceptions, oh, yeah. Like Eugene Debs later on, yes. Like later when the IWW was formed, and even later in Carpenters Union history, there was an instance where they tried to organize timber workers in Bogalusa, Mississippi, mm-hmm. in which there was, I think, six Carpenter Union organizers who were murdered by the local Klan and vigilantes working for the timber companies. So it's a mixed bag. It's like, it you is. Know, I think for the most part, it was more, racism, I think, was for the most part institutionalized in unions. Mm-hmm. Between, you know, the 18, you know, well, basically, you can go back a long ways, yeah, up until really the 1960s, you know, is when it really kind of broke open, but you still got problems today.
Yeah, that goes back into the foundational aspects of psychological racism on the white workers and mm-hmm. saying that, okay, I'm working alongside this person who is black. And we're both workers. I'm making more money than he is, and my skin is white. So my background and my cultural and socioeconomic background is not in the most inferior form of labor, which was slavery. So they have that, they have this psychological edge that Du Bois talks about.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, that's another way to create that schism amongst the whites and black
sure.
workers in
the
factories.
The same is true for women.
Oh, yeah.
We
yeah.
still, in this country, cannot pass the Equal Rights Amendment.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing?
It died
yeah.
in the 70s.
You know, well, I want to say, yeah. I find a different thing between what I'm going to call Americans and Mexicans on construction jobs, anyway, union construction jobs, mm-hmm. than I do between white and black workers.
Mm-hmm.
It's a completely different thing, and I don't know if it's because of the history of Mexicans coming here voluntarily. Mm-hmm. You know, they're economic refugees, but more or less voluntarily. You know, like, it feels like it's like, I mean, they'll call us hillbillies, we'll call them beaners, you know, and stuff like that, and it's not that big of a deal. It's really strange, the difference.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is what's interesting. I mean, in my own personal experience, working with, you know, both white and African-American workers, I worked a little bit around Latino workers, but not much. But it's interesting. It seems like for the most part, not in every case, but the most part, it seems like African-American workers that I've worked with were better union people. It seems like they get the boss worker, slave, master, whole, you know, concept. I mean, where a lot of the white workers buy into this crap about the boss is your friend and that we, you know, this
stuff.
Well,
every survey every year always shows that African Americans are more for unions than white Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And it's attributed to the idea that they've always had to self-organize and nobody was going to do anything for them.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And look at Flexengate. That's what's real interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, you have four distinct ethnic groups of employees at Flexengate. You had the African Congolese workers. You had the Latino workers from mainly Mexico, probably some from Central America. You had African American workers, and then you had European American slash white workers mm-hmm. there. And it was interesting because when the UAW was in here organizing, I think it was 99% of the Congolese workers were for the union. About 60-70% of the Latino workers were for the union. About 40% of the African Americans were for the union, but only less than 10% of the white workers were for the union.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and here with the Latino workers, a lot of them are undocumented. They got a lot to lose.
Yeah.
You know, yet they, you know, it must go back, you know, and I thought the same thing before too, Bill. You know, Latin America, especially Mexico, they've got sort of, I mean, granted it's fading with time.
Well,
but
where's
our
Zapatistas?
Well, exactly.
You know.
Yeah, and the fact that they have a more of a strong union tradition in Mexico and Latin America, and not to mention the Mexican Revolution was 100 years ago, you know, and stuff. So I attribute part of it to that. I don't know, or maybe because, I don't know. You know, this is good questions.
I mean, a lot of things also, too, you know, this whole, we have to really, not necessarily appreciate, but we have to recognize the power of mass media and propaganda.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you know, this, you know, especially during these world wars and these big national push. You know, that, you know, you're not an American, you're not a nationalist if you go against your country, if you're subversive to the capitalism and things like that. So you're gonna have that's one of the major reasons why you have white workers outside of psychological racism is saying that I'm not gonna go against this because I'm proud of my country. I'm working. I'm a working class person. I'm working hard. I'm doing these types of things. Mm-hmm. And again, like Bill said, you have this internal mechanism to organize because of the oppression. Resistance has to come out of it, and it's been happening since 1619 when the Africans first came. That this is not a situation, we have to protest our conditions as slaves, we have to protest our conditions as sharecroppers in agrarian capitalism, we have to in factory workers in industrial capitalism, and now today in neoliberal capitalism, we have to protest our ways as public sector workers, low-skilled workers, fast food workers, whatever that's left now for anybody to try to make any type of living, we have to organize around that and protest and try to get better conditions.
Yeah, it's
the real irony here is that the skilled craftsmen, the millwrights, the tool and die makers, nobody are teaching these trades. We can't bring these industries back without having trade schools.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, when I was in Milwaukee, you could graduate from Boys Tech High School, which you'd have half academics, and then half training. You could graduate and you could become a journeyman in any craft that was taught in the school.
Or you could go on to college. And, you know, I always thought education should be a mix of, you know, college level as well as, you know, practical, you know, skills, you know.
Yeah, I taught high school before I came up here.
Uh-huh.
And the only thing that they were pushing in my school system was college level. Like, I went and I asked them, where are the vocational schools? Where are the trade schools? What are the things that we can do? Because college is not for everybody because the ridiculous debt that it costs to be in education in this country.
Well, let's take
trade schools exist, it's been, they're not teaching this stuff in the public schools anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only place to learn it are these terrible for-profit trade schools, many of which are just pure scams that you never get jobs from. I mean, I know a young woman who was studying getting some kind of Homeland Security degree from this correspondence thing. It's like,
well,
what?
Look at this way. Jim, Bill, me, myself, we all have college degrees, but what do we do for a living? You're a laborer. I'm a carpenter. Jim's a retired railroad worker.
Yeah, but I also took welding in high school and had all these other things to take. And a lot of these schools, they just can't afford to have that stuff anymore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is, there's just like, you know, I think, why shouldn't, you have a mix of both, a healthy mix of both? Because as we know, there's not enough jobs. The highest, as far as I saw statistics about a year ago, the highest group of unemployed currently are college graduates, which
is, here's the thing though. We're not going to put those back in schools under this system, because you're gonna start having people clamoring and demanding that these jobs come back, because they're gonna have those skills in schools. And then what's gonna happen to that overseas profit margin? You know, mm-hmm. for neoliberalism, global capitalism is gonna start. You're gonna start seeing a kind of bend towards it. So of course, bringing that stuff back into school is gonna upset their plans for this global network system.
Yeah,
you know?
Okay, we're gonna have to.
It's sort of like, I believe in the German system, Dave, which mm-hmm. you might know more about than I mm-hmm. do. You basically go to school till you're 16, and this is pretty general in Europe, mm-hmm. and then have the choice, and you can go into a union apprenticeship, more or less.
Or clerical school or whatever, yeah.
But education is free in Europe, education, but the thing is, if it's going to be free, I bet they're fairly picky about who gets in. And
well, it is based on the grades, but what's?
But I mean, here's what I'm saying is that under that system, though, I think the skills are proportioned better, and people are probably set off in more realistic mm-hmm, directions. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. See, but the wealthy always have, or wealthy upper middle class always have an option. If their kids can't get the grades to get into public free schools, they've always got the money to send them to private schools.
Yeah.
But what I find tragically worse than that, I can't shed too many tears for those people. What I find tragically bad is a poor working class kid that has, you know, excelled in high school and can't afford to go to college.
Yeah.
I mean, or takes on massive debt to where they become a serf, you know, debt peonage, a debt indentured servitude, you know. How many people, I mean, that's, you know, you wonder why there isn't more political activity going on campuses and stuff. Well,
you can look at the demographic population of who's coming to these campuses now, because, like you say, a lot of people cannot afford the working class, the activist minded community people cannot afford to go to these campuses. So they're taking these elite rural planter family generation people, and they're going to colleges right now. Mm-hmm. And then of course, when you have activism on campus, they're not going to have that connection, that relationship to struggle in their lives. So they're not going to take that kind of personal, you know.
Well, and I think what I really worry about is the media. Because you basically cannot get a job in any media in the United States without at least a bachelor's degree. Well, you can get an associate's. Yeah.
Well, you have a master's and you'd never.
That's a scheduling mistake. I should have got 5 years work experience in there.
Okay, but
see,
whatever.
A lot of people are doing that. They're going right on to graduate school because they can't find a job. Basically, what they're doing is they're really screwing themselves bad.
Because then they're overqualified. For
right.
A lot. Uh-huh.
Exactly. You can't. Wow. Exactly. But anyway, what's going to happen is that. And especially in the media, you have to do an internship, especially mm-hmm. if you're going to do like producing or reporting, at least one semester. So that means you're paying to work for free.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on top of the rest of your schooling. And so that kind of filters out your, less wealthy people from what less wealthy parts of town. Mm-hmm. You know, I hate all this. I hate saying working class, or lower class, or as Jim says,
you know, one of your big pet peeves is what you call middle class values. You know, he said you can understand because you've corrected me on that before. You know, when I meant to say I was referring to middle class jobs, basically meaning middle class incomes. Where you said that you should specifically state that and not say
middle income, not middle class.
Yeah, because
no,
I mean,
not even that. Middle class, the whole word to me is horrid. We want anarchist and revolutionary social democrats alike a classless society that we can run ourselves democratically. Middle class values. If you're middle class, yet serve yourself and screw your fellow worker.
And laugh at your neighbor's misfortunes. Yeah. You know,
and your function is to help the capitalists. I mean, that's definitely the definition of middle class.
Because one day you might be rich too, right?
I'm just a temporarily inconvenienced millionaire.
Okay.
And the middle class, again, the middle class is the petite bourgeois, because they're sitting there thinking that they're above something, where they themselves are also vastly oppressed. They're still, I mean, you can look at the NFL, NBA teams right now. They're sitting there, they have $1 million contracts, but they're producing over billions of dollars of profit. So they're not even making like what 2 or 3% of what they're actually producing. I mean, they're some of the most oppressed groups ever are the NFL.
Who
NBA
was the
teams.
Phrase that, when they had the strike, the was the football strike.
Millionaires versus billionaires.
Yeah.
I'm just saying though, like, you know, and then of course you're under contract, so they control everything you do.
That's the average career of a,
how much does it cost now? Can a middle-income family affordably even attend these sporting events anymore? It's like $200-$300 if you live across the road, you know?
Yeah.
And it didn't used to be that way. These guys, they're just charging way too much
We can even bring in the fact that they're building all of these stadiums and tearing down a lot of those community areas and those working-class neighborhoods.
And being subsidized with our tax dollars to make private property.
Just look at the university down the road. They put those ugly, awful skyboxes on Memorial Stadium.
Yeah, Frank Lloyd Wright design, no less.
And... everything that's going on pretty much at the, State Farm Center.
No, Assembly Hall.
Okay, now is to, they're taking away access areas on one end of a row of seats to put another seat in each row, so then you have to go all the way from the other end. And they're closing off doorways, entrances into the building to put in more seats.
Oh,
and
wow.
They're having this, they're doing a box kind of thing there.
Oh man.
And it's going to be, you know, $125, $150 to go to a concert at least. I mean, they've been running like that for years.
You know, thank you Gus so much for coming on as any of our wonderful shows, which I'd consider this one of them in the past. Unfortunately, one show sort of births a possibility of three future shows with the topics we happen to hit on because all this stuff's interconnected. So Gus, thank you so much for coming on and
thank you.
I just want to mention that I am now a delegate from John with Justice to the Champaign County AFL-CIO, and I was pleasantly surprised to see that Gus is also a delegate.
I'm on the exec board.
Oh, you're on the executive board.
I'm on the exec board.
What's your position on the executive board?
I'm a trustee.
Trustee, okay. Yep. And you're also president of the GEO, Graduate Employees?
Yes. Very happy to be president of an organization that what we're doing.
So, okay. Yeah,
we're doing amazing things right now.
I think you're an amazing person for able to do all that stuff. So thanks so much for coming on the show.
You've
been listening to the World Labor Hour on Listener Supported Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign, Illinois, and stay tuned for the Union Edge. And until next week, be safe and power to the people. Take care.